This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The second half of the Major League Baseball season is underway, and every division but one seems likely to produce a pennant race. There, having thoroughly jinxed the Red Sox, runaway leaders in the American League East, I'll leave it to our baseball expert, Tim Kirkjian of ESPN, to bail me out. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Great being here, Bill.
It's been a few days now since the 78th All-Star Game in San Francisco. The American League won again. Was the Midsummer Classic every bit the spectacle that you had hoped it would be?
Yes, I thought it was really good. It was very entertaining. It was very athletic. And I thought baseball really did well for itself because we saw Jose Reyes run really fast. And we saw Carl Crawford run really fast and hit a home run. Of course, we saw Ichiro run really fast and hit the first inside the park home run in the history of the All-Star game. And all that did well for the game to show people again that these guys are really good athletes, or as Carl Crawford told me, we're not just a bunch of fat guys sitting around eating hot dogs. So I think that was good. Plus, it had some great drama at the end, and it had the whole Barry Bonds saga. It had a really cool appearance by Willie Mays. The ballpark was sensational. So overall, I thought a very successful All-Star game.
All of that notwithstanding, ratings for the All-Star Game fell by almost 10% from last year. Is this a sign that the event is losing a bit of luster, or did fans not want to see Barry Bonds receive a hero's welcome from the hometown crowd?
Well, it could be a little bit of both there. I think the Barry Bonds story has worn on a lot of our fans. I think some of them are a little bit tired of hearing about it. I'm not sure he's the reason that there wasn't a big draw, but, you know, for the life of me, I'm not sure why it wouldn't be a good rating given the season we've had. It's been the season of milestones already, and we're far, far away from finishing all those milestones, plus great pennant races. I think overall very interesting baseball so far, so I don't get it. I thought it's been a great year. I thought it should have shown in the All-Star game, and I guess it didn't in the ratings.
Bonds' quest for 756 home runs and the all-time record held by Hank Aaron will likely end at some point within the next few weeks. There's been a lot of speculation that Commissioner Bud Selig may not be there when Bonds breaks that record. Some of your brethren have wondered, breathlessly in some cases, about the implications of Bud skipping out on the event, but does it really matter?
Well, I think it matters to a degree. I mean, we're talking about the commissioner of baseball being there when the greatest record in the history of baseball, and I think the greatest record in sports, is broken. I just don't know how he can justify not being there. And if he's worried that people are going to say, oh, this happened on your watch, Bud, well, of course it did, the whole steroid issue. And also, but he's far from the only guy to blame on this, Bill. I mean, we've got owners and general managers and the Players Association and the media who all missed this story. Bud is not alone, you know, in a very awkward, uncomfortable position. And I think it'll be more awkward and more uncomfortable if he doesn't go. And I think he will go in the end, but I've heard all the whispers. I know friends of his who say they don't think he's going to go, but I think in the end, you know, he's kind of waiting for something to happen so he doesn't have to go. But I think ultimately he will go because ultimately he has to go.
The Yankees had a losing record at the All-Star break and have trailed the Boston Red Sox in the AL East by at least 10 games almost the entire year. Yet when shortstop Derek Jeter was recently asked if New York could catch its rivals, the team captain said, no question. Has the ghost of Joe Pepitone taken Derek Jeter's mind away?
Well, this is typical Derek Jeter to be Mr. Positive. We can do something here. And I know at the All-Star game he was very upbeat about the second half. I totally disagree with him, though. I don't think they can catch the Red Sox. The Red Sox pitching, I think, ultimately is too good. I think the Yankees need to focus just on making the wild card. And if they make the wild card this year, it will be miraculous in many ways, given how poorly they played for the majority of the first half. Now, I fully expect them to get hot the second half. They began the second half of the season with 29 straight games against teams with a losing record. I think they're going to be in the playoff mix, but I don't think they're going to beat the Red Sox.
Well, I feel very happy to have company because now you, too, have jinxed the Red Sox.
Well, I've done that before. I also picked the Yankees to win the World Series this year, Bill. So I've got a professional stake in this that they make the playoffs. It's not like I'm rooting, but I know when to give up. They're too far out to beat the Red Sox.
In the National League, the St. Louis Cardinals have struggled mightily since winning the 2006 World Series. The Cards are mired in third place in the NL Central with a losing record. Can Tony La Russa's club turn things around in time to have a shot at defending their title?
I don't think so, Bill. I just think they've lost too much this year, too many injuries, including to Chris Carpenter, their best pitcher. They've had some internal problems there also, and mostly the Brewers are better than we thought they were. And even though they're not a runaway great team by any purposes, I think their young talent is going to be good enough to hold off the Cardinals. And I think the Cubs in the second half of the season. Now, is it possible for the Cardinals to get back in this? Yes. Do I think it's going to happen? No. And Tony La Russa is not going to be very happy about that if they don't get back in this.
In the American League west of Major League Baseball, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim are in first place. And that's not a surprise. What is a surprise is the second place Seattle Mariners, picked by lots of people to finish near the bottom of the division. The Mariners are right behind the Angels. Do they stay there?
I think they stay there, but I don't think they make the playoffs as the wild card, and I think they're a clear second-place team to the Angels, even though the Angels have slumped a little lately and the Mariners have played extremely well. What this has done, Bill, even if they don't make the playoffs, it has convinced Ichiro Suzuki, their terrific center fielder, to sign with the Mariners for a five-year deal for an enormous amount of money. So even if they don't make the playoffs, this push they've made lately, the improvement they've made, I think is going to keep Ichiro around, and I think that's as important as making the playoffs because they would have no shot of making the playoffs if he left as a free agent after this year.
Tim Kirkjian covers Major League Baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Tim, thanks again.
Thank you, Bill.
As Major League Baseball's teams return to work following the All-Star Game, few of them had more reason to look forward to the second half of the season than the Cleveland Indians. Bunched with the defending American League champion Tigers, Cleveland has been as consistent as any team in baseball. Though the club hasn't won more than six games in a row, they've avoided losing streaks. Their ace, C.C. Sabathia, says Cleveland has the feel of a winner.
You know, in situations when, you know, critical situations come up in the game, you just feel like guys are going to get the hits, you know, and guys are going to make pitches, things like that. So it's a good feeling to know that, you know, you can depend on guys and guys are going to make plays.
Guys certainly have been making the plays behind the 6'7" Sabathia, who leads the Indians with 12 wins against just three losses in 133 innings pitched. Though he won't turn 27 until a week from today, Sabathia celebrated his birthday at the All-Star Game this week and contributed a scoreless inning for the victorious American League side. Sabathia has been backed up by Fausto Carmona, who's won 10 games, and Joe Borowski, who had a league-leading 25 saves before the break. But according to third base coach Joel Skinner, Cleveland's strength is that they don't have to rely exclusively on anybody.
I think it's just a matter of guys just going out and not trying to do too much. As a result, you keep an inning alive, you turn the lineup over offensively, you do the little things. A walk in the third inning, you know, might mean something in the fifth inning because now maybe a different hitter's up. Those are the types of things that go unnoticed, but when you're winning ball games, you have a big to do with it.
The fact that Victor Martinez, who whacked a two-run home run in the All-Star game, is hitting well over 300 with almost 70 runs batted in also has something to do with Cleveland's success, but nobody else in the lineup has been nearly that productive, which lends credibility to Joel Skinner's emphasis on the team effort, the kind of effort that you might think would seriously excite Cleveland fans. But Terry Pluto, who writes about sports for the Akron Beacon Journal, suggests thinking again.
The hardcore are excited. The problem is, just like Cleveland's population has gone down over the years or whatever, so is the hardcore baseball fan here. And they're 25th in attendance, Bill. I mean, out of 30 teams. That's really low. So basically what I'm saying is this. The Indians have a really good team, and I don't think they're getting quite the support that they should.
That may be in part because Indians fans, even in the days when they were numerous enough to fill the ballpark in Cleveland, were reluctant to hope for too much. And even though the Red Sox, who hadn't won in forever, were champs in 2004, and the White Sox, who hadn't won in forever, were champs in 2005, according to Terry Pluto, Cleveland fans can't perceive a trend.
We never think it's our turn here. We always figure something will go wrong. We are rated the highest on the ESPN Sports Misery Index, you know, for all cities and all pro sports cities. We're proud of our misery, and we just expect something to go wrong. We never think it's our turn.
That reasoning suggests that from a Cleveland perspective, things would only go wrong if the Indians were to win it all, which, look out, Cleveland, is actually a distinct possibility. This team has home run hitters scattered throughout the lineup, two starting pitchers on track to win 20 games, a successful, if anxiety-provoking, closer. How does one avoid optimism, if not euphoria, when contemplating Cleveland's prospects? John Heyman, senior writer at Sports Illustrated and SportsIllustrated.com, had to stretch for bad news.
They're not as experienced as, let's say, the Red Sox or the Yankees get in, or even the Angels. Their players, you know, just don't have that playoff experience. But on the other hand, they have very good starting pitching, certainly at the top with Sabathia, one of the better pitchers in the league. Carmona's been very good. So, you know, they have the pitching, the starting pitching, and they certainly have a dangerous lineup. So right now they look like the fourth-best team. But look, the Cardinals won last year with 83 victories. This Indians team's as good as that one. So, you know, they've got a shot.
Cleveland's most direct route to the postseason would be to finish first in the AL Central Division, leaving the worry of beating the other wild card contenders to the Detroit Tigers. That circumstance and the battle the Indians and Tigers waged over the last few weeks of the 06 season tempts one to view Cleveland-Detroit as a genuine rivalry. But C.C. Sabathia refuses to be drawn into seeing his club's challenge in that light.
We know that the division is good, and we know that we have to take care of business in the division. So I think every game in our division is big, with the White Sox, the Tigers, the Royals. Even, you know, the Royals, they came in there and took two away from us. So, you know, Minnesota. So, you know, we know our division is tough, and pretty much every game is a rival game in the division.
It's perhaps especially appropriate that Sabathia is currently thinking that way. His next start is tonight against the Royals. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Faster Times, Summer in the City. But first, on Tuesday, sports agent Gustavo Dominguez was sentenced to 5 years in prison for smuggling Cuban baseball players into the United States. According to prosecutors, Dominguez paid $225,000 to a small-time drug trafficker to run five Cuban ball players in a fast boat from Cuba to Big Pine Key, a stretch of beach 30 miles north of Key West. To avoid Major League Baseball's rules that require players from Cuba to enter the amateur draft, three of Dominguez's charges traveled to the Dominican Republic and became free agents. Numerous Cuban players, Jose Contreras, for example, and El Duque Hernandez, have found their way to Major League teams by similar means, but nobody had previously been prosecuted for aiding them in their flight from Cuba or for helping them find work in baseball in the U.S. Joining me now is Roberto Gonzalez Echevarria, Sterling Professor of Hispanic and Comparative Literatures at Yale University and author of Pride of Havana, A History of Cuban Baseball. Professor Gonzalez Echevarria, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, I'm very happy to be here with you.
It used to be that Cuban athletes defected during overseas tournaments. This was a fairly common occurrence, rather than paying smugglers and risking the open seas. Why did that change?
Well, because they have clamped down, and hence it has become very difficult for them to bolt to freedom. I hate the word defect. They have clamped down. I mean, during the so-called baseball classic, I have information that the players were kept as prisoners. When they were in Puerto Rico, the hotel rooms had no telephones or televisions, and they were being followed constantly by security agents. But others have continued to leave from teams. For instance, recently, I think it was a wrestler in Germany, for instance. And then, of course, there are these two soccer players who recently left their team here in a tournament.
Well, those are the two guys I next wanted to talk about. Lester Moray and Osvaldo Alonso are trying out this week with Chivas USA. Alonso walked away from his teammates while they were shopping at a mall in Houston a few days after Moray left the team in New Jersey. Why were they so easily able to get away? Is it just that they're not paying as much attention to soccer players as they have been to baseball players?
Of course, yeah. I mean, soccer is not a very important sport in Cuba, and the Cuban soccer teams do not do very well. So they focus on baseball because it's one of the propaganda icons of the regime.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to keep the players there and avoid a scandal. I mean, when someone like El Duque or Contreras or even Kendry Morales escapes, it's news. Well, these two guys, no one's really paying attention to them. I don't know if they'll be able to make it in soccer here. I mean, soccer was very big in Cuba in the 1920s and the 30s, but it hasn't been in the last 50 or 60 years.
The team for which these two Cuban players are trying out, Chivas USA, has only one roster spot available currently, and there's no guarantee that either player will be chosen to fill it. Similarly, a number of baseball players who've come here with the dream of playing in the big leagues have not made major league rosters. What happens to those who don't succeed in finding a job in pro sports?
I'm sure that they are very happy to be here, to be free and to go on with their lives. I mean, what happens to them when their career is over in Cuba? They have no no future and they live in poverty and also, of course, in a repressive atmosphere. So I'm sure that there have been over 100 baseball players who have left Cuba in the last 20 years or so, and only a few have made it to the major leagues. I remember one who was working in a grocery store in Miami with whom I communicated. Betancourt was his name. He was an older man. He left during the Baltimore-Cuba game. He was
mm-hmm.
a coach,
mm-hmm.
and he couldn't get much, but he was happy to be here. Others have joined little academies in Miami to teach kids how to play baseball and so forth. I mean, what happens to the many Americans who were don't make it to the major league?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
The Cuban exile community is said to view Gus Dominguez as a heroic figure, and several well-known retired ballplayers, including former Dodger pitcher Sandy Koufax, wrote to the judge on behalf of Dominguez. I wonder, do you know whether that had any impact on the sentence Mr. Dominguez received?
There was a mandatory minimum sentence. So when you're dealing with a mandatory sentence, there's very little a judge can do. I think that he was lenient in the sense that he imposed the minimum mandatory sentence. And in that sense, the letters from Koufax and some of the others may have helped.
Do you think the prosecution of Gus Dominguez is likely to change the way smugglers, agents, and ballplayers in Cuba have been doing business?
I don't know. There was another one who was prosecuted in Cuba for trying to smuggle players out. He was working for one of the agents in Miami, and I think he's currently in jail in Cuba. I would have to look that up. But no, I think that people will continue to try to escape from Cuba as the situation deteriorates further, if that is possible. And the current situation is really as bad as it has been in the past 49 years. So people will always try to escape, not just ball players. I mean, people are escaping to Central America and Mexico in rickety boats. It's going to be interesting to see what happens now in Brazil in the Pan American Games. Cuba is sending a team with the cream of their ball players, many of whom played in the Classic. I'm sure they're going to be very, very closely guarded. But, I mean, someone like Yulieski Gurriel, the second baseman, who's supposed to be one of the better players in Cuba, he's getting to be 23, 24. So they must feel a great deal of pressure to leave and to make something of themselves as soon as possible. I see that Escobar, for instance, is doing very well with the Braves, mm-hmm. an infielder. I don't know if you've been following him. Escobar, they say, is excellent, and he has broken into a very, very good lineup. And he was playing, I don't think he was even a first-string player with Industriales.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of players in Cuba who would have a chance, and I'm sure that they're going to try to continue to leave by whichever way.
Major League Baseball's policy regarding Cuban ball players seems to encourage illegal smuggling of players. Should Major League Baseball take some of the responsibility for what's been going on here?
Well, I don't know if it encourages it. I mean, it encourages by just existing, by just being there. And it's near enough, that is. I mean, if Japan were within an easy trip of the United States, other players would go to Japan.
Roberto Gonzalez Echeverria is the author of Pride of Havana, A History of Cuban Baseball. Professor Gonzalez Echeverria, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
It will not be news to many that the popularity of NASCAR long ago transcended geographical limitations. Watching cars race around ovals very quickly while exceptionally close to one another has become the second most popular television sport, topped only by the spectacle of watching gigantic men crash into each other at considerable cost to their knees, shoulders, and brains. But NASCAR's workforce has been limited, mostly to white males. The sport is trying to change that, partly by co-sponsoring schools dedicated to diversity in motorsports. Stacia DeMarco recently visited one of those schools in Philadelphia, and she has this report.
The Urban Youth Racing School is located on a cobblestone street under a highway overpass, surrounded by abandoned lots, graffiti, and trash. There's no sign above the locked door, only a security camera, a stark reminder of life in the inner city. But once you enter the building, a vibrant world opens before your eyes. Teens sprawl in the lounge area on sofas, watching a big flat-screen monitor tuned to a race. In the next room, students work on cars and enter data into multiple computers. Instructor Daniel Kilson explains how a car's onboard computer works.
It works at 350, yeah. And then you can look at the 2300 RPMs.
Uh-huh.
So that was our engine temperature. You know, now I can start scrolling back from our previous race.
In the back room, students wrench on mini cup cars, which are smaller versions of stock cars seen on NASCAR tracks, in preparation for the team's next big race. Anthony Martin is the force behind the Urban Youth Racing School, also known as UYRS.
Did you know you could change tires and make $100,000 a year changing tires in the racing business? The goal was just to introduce them to the different jobs and let them know that these jobs exist. If you don't know, how are you going to be a part of it?
In 1998, Martin and a few of his friends wanted to show the kids from their inner city neighborhoods what NASCAR was all about and its potential to change their lives. The only problem was that the inner-city kids were never exposed to the sport. So Martin and his friends brought NASCAR to them in the form of evening and weekend workshops that actually got kids behind the wheel.
But we say to them, listen, you know what, you go through our Build a Dream program and you feel like this is what you want to do with your life, you become part of our driver team development program, and they either become drivers in that program or they become mechanics in that program. They went this for a few years. Once they go through that program, they're then on their way to college.
With the help of corporate sponsorship money, 150 students a year attend the school on scholarship. Currently, there are over 2,000 students who have been through the program, and it has expanded to a second branch in Washington, D.C. Today, each school has a wait list of close to 800 students. 15-year-old Jade Gillis enrolled in UYRS when she was 10. She heard about the program from a friend, begged her mom to join, and has been a racing school addict ever since. She's currently the only girl racing at the advanced level. And although she's uneasy about driving a passenger car next year when she gets her driver's license, she's quite comfortable cruising at 70-plus miles per hour in a mini cup around the raceway.
After, like, racing a little bit, we started going places like to Dover and to North Carolina, and we started driving different kind of cars, like not just the go-karts. We went other places and drove like faster cars on different tracks, and we got the hang of it, had little competitions and races and stuff like that.
But Jade knows that one of UYRS's goals is to become smarter as well as faster. School grades play as much of a role, if not more, as racing school grades when it comes to incentive to stay in the program. Students are permitted to miss only one class in the 10-week introductory session, or they are kicked out. And this commitment to academic excellence is still very important to Jade. She makes an hour commute by bus and train every day to attend a good public school and the racing school. While she sees herself out on the raceway breaking all kinds of records, she also recognizes the importance of college and what lies beyond.
With the racing part, I mean, if I can't get to the racing part that good, then the business side of NASCAR is just as great as the racing. There's a lot of money involved, and I like money, so that would be great.
19-year-old Lamont Ebron has been in the program for 5 years, and like Jade Gillis, he wants a career in auto racing. But his introduction to the school was a bit different than Jade's.
Basically, I had no direction at all. I was just clueless. You know, my dad didn't live with us or anything. And, you know, just watching my mom go to work and all of that, you know, I just really had no direction. I had no clue what I wanted to be. Nothing really to look forward to or up to at all.
Lamont says the Urban Youth Racing School gave him the direction and motivation he was lacking. He has taken full advantage of the networking made available through internships and by making friends with the bigwigs he meets at the track.
You know, one of the top-notch teams in NASCAR, which is Hendrick Motorsports. That's my goal, to work at Hendrick Motorsports. Initially, I wanted to be a mechanic, but now I'm leaning more towards some of the upstairs work, maybe in the PR department or the communications marketing department.
And it seems Lamont's hard work has paid off. This fall, he will attend Johnson C. Smith University, a small school that just happens to be located in Charlotte, North Carolina, a NASCAR hub and home to Hendrick Motorsports. Lamont will also have a part-time job with Hendrick while in school. The Urban Youth Racing School could produce its first professional NASCAR driver next year. And as the school enters its 10th year, founder Anthony Martin says there are big plans for it. He hopes to open programs in Chicago, Miami, New York City, Los Angeles, and Detroit over the next few years. But he says he is proud of what his school has already accomplished.
We've also saved lives in our program. We really have saved lives, where kids came in with D averages and gave an opportunity, and then they got their grades up and graduated and things like that. If they didn't have a race in school, they probably would have dropped out of school, could be 6 foot under, whatever. But the school was able to save those kids.
For Only a Game, I'm Stacia DeMarco in Philadelphia.
When I was 15, I got a part-time job working on motors down at Joe's Garage. I did my schooling underneath the hood of a Chevy or a Ford T-Bird. Down at the track every Saturday night, you ran a fast car that I wanted to drive. I made pit crew chief in less than a year. The one night he put me in gear.
You're listening to Only a Game. As the riders competing in the Tour de France shifted into climbing mode late this week, commentator Alyssa Eli found her thoughts turning to pedaling as well. Her aspirations were more humble. Nevertheless, the experience was frustrating.
You head out on a bike ride hoping for a little meditative time, maybe some aerobic exercise. It's all part of a grand plan to shave down the creeping body mass index. But other things happen while you're making plans. I took the local bike path. It's one of the oldest in the country, 11 miles in each direction. It ends on the tracks of a commuter rail line, which is convenient if you need help getting home. There's a white line down the middle of the path. Etiquette signs are posted everywhere. Stay in line, single file, let faster riders pass. These are sensible rules for human beings sharing life's road. Younger riders sped past, shouting in terse biker dialect, "On your left, your left, your left." It's not restful to hear, but it's proper. They are stronger and faster and have the right to the center of the road. Riders coming in the other direction also pass on the left, which meant my lane was becoming quickly crowded. Some bikers didn't even mean to pass. They were just ambling along in groups of twos and threes, fanned out, chatting. To accommodate them, I was forced over, farther and farther right. This is against my political inclinations and certainly against the rules. By mile 5, I was unsettled. By mile 8, I was steaming. If one more chatty group crowded me for their own pleasure, I'd be off the road and in the gully. The group in question approached. There were 4 of them, side by side, speaking to each other animatedly, not a bit interested in propriety or oncoming traffic. They were not in line. They were not in single file. They did not care. Enough was enough. With some deep rage summoned on behalf of all bikers edged off bike paths, I screamed in the coarsest middle-aged voice I could manage, "Get off my side!" It was a satisfying moment. I felt Vesuvius had spoken. The 4 looked at me in shock. Probably no one had ever brought them to justice before. "Good," one said something to the rest. I cycled closer to hear the response. Once and for all, they needed to understand. The only problem was, they weren't speaking English.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist and writer who's regularly featured on Only a Game. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, dingers for the deity and touchdowns with theological implications. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who's in NPR's New York Bureau, for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Everyone's favorite NBA owner, Mark Cuban, has applied to buy the Chicago Cubs. The Chicago Tribune heralded this development by saying, most observers think Major League Baseball would balk at a potential owner as unpredictable and outspoken as Cuban. Cuban has refused to comment because most observers were not named. So, Charlie, what the heck? You're an observer. Are you willing to go on the record?
I was really worried that there would never be another context in which Mark Cuban could be an insufferable know-nothing blowhard. Phew! What a relief! There are the Cubs!
This week, the Yankees announced that they are willing to break precedent and negotiate an extension for Alex Rodriguez during the season. Representing Mr. Rodriguez, Scott Boras announced that his client doesn't feel like negotiating right now. He just expects to be paid more than $30 million a year from now on. So what a good way to start discussions, huh?
Well, there's no compelling reason for Alex Rodriguez, given the season he's having. There's no compelling reason for him to negotiate till after this wonderful season is over, when he has every bit of leverage he can possibly have. I mean, he's not particularly devoted to the concept of being a Yankee, since he hasn't exactly embraced or been embraced by the city of New York. So I think he's going to put the Yankees on a spit and slow roast them until the end of November.
Ricky Henderson has joined the Mets as their new hitting coach. So how many of the current Mets will soon be hitting leadoff home runs?
Well, that's an interesting thing. People forget that the great gift and the great wonder of Ricky Henderson was the amount of power he had. I think if he keeps his mind on his job, he'll be a terrific addition to a very good young lineup.
How long before he requests that they activate him?
No, he won't. I honestly asked somebody that today. I honestly believe he doesn't want to be activated.
The New York Mets cut the man who had been rumored as a possible contender for the job Henderson took. 48-year-old Julio Franco was replaced this week by an outfielder less than half his age, so probably the last we'll see of Julio.
The mother of mercy, is this the end of Julio? I thought he was going to make it to 50. I was kind of rooting for him to make it to 50, to play in the major leagues when he's 50. I don't know. Are you telling me that Tampa Bay Devil Rays couldn't use him? There are three teams in the American League East that could use Julio Franco, including the Yankees, I might add. I've got to think he's going to hook on somewhere for a few games.
On Wednesday, Charlie, it was reported that Oklahoma must, quote, vacate its 2005 football season after failing to monitor two players who were paid for work they did not do at a Norman car dealership. What does vacate mean in this context, and how much does a punishment like this really hurt a major football school?
Well, it means you don't get your security deposit back from the NCAA, which is really a terrible thing for smaller schools, but not such a big deal for Oklahoma. It means the five wins they had in that season don't count anymore. Basically, it means that the season didn't happen, basically. And the five wins that you profited by and whatever TV revenues came from them, you don't have them anymore.
Don Nelson, who has 2 years remaining on his $6.2 million contract to coach the Golden State Warriors, wishes to be paid more money to do that job. Does he have a case for requesting a raise?
No, he sort of does in the same way that raises are doled out in professional sports. He's always been very impressed with his own ability. I predict that this will not end well in Golden State for him.
Speaking of millions of dollars, a former women's volleyball coach from Fresno State, fired in 2004, was awarded $5.8 million this week in what was apparently the largest settlement ever granted to a coach suing for retaliation under Title IX. Was this case an anomaly, or do Title IX advocates have reason to celebrate?
Well, they have a couple of reasons to celebrate this week. They have this case, which is a vindication for them, and they have a General Accountability Office report that seems to back up their notion of continuing gender inequity in college sports. This is a huge verdict, both for the advocates of Title IX and for this woman in specific. But it's also a further indication of how far down the big major sport rabbit hole Fresno State fell over the last 15 years. It started when they hired Jerry Tarkanian, whom everybody knew was going to get in trouble, to run their basketball program, and it just hasn't stopped.
Earlier this week, during a practice session at the Pan Am Games, a Brazilian fencer was accidentally stabbed by his brother. Surgery was required, and the fencer in question had to drop from the games, although I gather he's okay now. I thought this kind of thing only happened in Hamlet.
No, it happens a lot. Generally, what happens is one of the fencer's blades will break, and he will continue with his action with a jagged and broken blade, and that will do the damage. There's a very famous episode about 20 years ago between a German fencer and a Russian fencer where the blade broke and went through the mask of the Russian fencer and killed him on the spot.
Oof.
And the German fencer in question, who's a very, very talented fencer, wound up in an institution for a while coping with it. So while it's very unusual, it does happen.
Having discovered that a limited number of U.S. citizens care about professional ice hockey, the National Hockey League announced this week that the Anaheim Ducks will play the Los Angeles Kings in London on September 29th, almost exactly 1 month before the NFL plays a regular season game in Wembley Stadium. This sounds to me kind of like when the younger sister announces her wedding for the week before her older sister.
That's right. This is pure spite on the NHL's part. But I will tell you, I believe firmly that having an NHL game in London makes infinitely more sense than having two NHL teams in Florida.
The league's public relations strategy also involves staging a game outdoors on New Year's Day. No competition for the sports fans' attention on New Year's Day, right?
Do you suppose they just didn't Google it? Let's just January 1, sure, just throw it out there. Nothing else is going on.
Right,
Everybody's hungover. Well, they'll watch an outdoor hockey game when there are 57 bowl games to be played.
David Beckham was officially introduced to U.S. soccer fans in Los Angeles yesterday, Charlie, and the Galaxy reported that
all five of them were there.
Now, take it easy. 250,000 people have already ordered Beckham jerseys, even though they didn't know what the jerseys would look like at the time. I guess they were just confident in the sartorial taste of the Galaxy's design staff. It must have been it.
That's the event. Now we'll see whether it actually sells the sport. You know, he'll have the one time around the league. He'll be, hey, David Beckham is coming to Columbus, and there'll be, you know, David Beckham Day in Columbus, and then we'll see the second time around the league whether or not he gets incomprehensibly bored by the American soccer climate or whether or not he can do what he's been brought here to do.
All right, which do you think is more embarrassing for 14-year-old Wycota Fisher, a soon-to-be freshman at Yorktown High School in Texas? A, being the only kid cut from the cheerleading squad, or B, having her mother sue the school for cutting her, thus letting the world know that she was the only kid cut from the cheerleading squad?
Obviously, the second is the more embarrassing of two. But this, you have to understand, this is a vast improvement in the way moms in Texas react to their daughters being cut from cheerleading squad, because the last one of these stories we had, the mom tried to kill the other kid.
Yes, exactly. The World Schools Debating Championships crowned a champion this week, Charlie, and Sean Connery. Sean Connery was no doubt pleased by the result of the competition.
No, he wasn't. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's not debate. That's an argument.
No, I'm sorry. Well, debate's down the hall. Actually, yes, the Scots managed to overcome the feisty Kuwaitis in the World Finals on the subject resolved. If it's not Scottish, it's cop.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. In the introduction to his new book, Playing with God, subtitled Religion and Modern Sport, William J. Baker maintains that religion and sport seem to have been made in the image of each other, an assertion that may come as no surprise to the many Major League sluggers who point to the sky even as their home runs are clearing the fences. Those hitters may be less delighted with Dr. Baker's subsequent contention that religion and sport especially are joined at the altar of commercial interest. Bill Baker joins me now from the studios of Maine Public Radio in Bangor. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
What did you have in mind when you wrote that sports and religion were made in the image of each other?
Well, they're both born of passion. They're both born of discipline. They both thrive on spectacle of one sort or another, and they both thrive on ritual. Sport is filled with ritual just as religion is.
Of today's sports landscape, you write that evangelical religion and sport reinforce each other. I can see how an athlete under pressure might want to turn that pressure over to a higher power, but how does what happens on the field necessarily reinforce the athlete's beliefs?
Well, it's complex, but the evangelical athlete finds in his religion a kind of freedom to participate eagerly and enthusiastically, and really then, as it were, give it over to a higher power, that God will have his way and do his way. Moreover, the tradition recently of evangelicals in athletics is that athletics for them is a sort of podium for winning people to Christ. And athletics for them is that kind of platform and that kind of pitch.
We've all seen basketball players cross themselves before they take a foul shot. We've seen football players kneeling on the sideline, holding hands with their teammates with their heads bowed. In circumstances like that, what distinguishes religion from superstition?
That's a very fine line. To call on God or the gods to bend the universe in your favor is a very audacious kind of enterprise. And whether you call it prayer and religion or whether you call it superstition, there's always a fine line between those. So I don't think it's unique in sport. It is a part, I think, of the human condition that people grasp at whatever they can to make sense of their lives and to, as it were, shape their lives and their experience in a way that is to their advantage.
You point out that grafting nationalism to the partnership of religion and sport is a fairly recent development. How did that come about?
Well, it really began in the 19th century when nationalism boomed with flags and anthems and all kinds of references made to national states. It was after the Civil War in America when we survived the Civil War as a nation. It was also around the turn of the century into the 20th century where nation states everywhere were competing for dominance in their empires and in their wars. And religion became a part of the baggage of winning for God and winning for the nation state. In fact, it is to the point that it's only in the early 20th century that a national anthem was first sung in America. It was not until then that anybody considered using flags at sporting events and wrapping the nationalism into the religion.
And then, of course, the next step is not only the flags and the songs, but the jet fighters overhead as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And all of that also is then a commercial package, of course. And, you know, the Super Bowl is one of the great extravagant spectacles and I would say rituals in American life, and it is just permeated with religious symbols and nationalistic symbols and materialistic symbols.
Do you think that most fans tuning in to watch the Super Bowl, since that's the example that you've used, are aware that they're getting that entire package of nationalism, religion, as well as sport?
No, I think it would diminish probably the impact of it if they did, and I wouldn't suggest that there are hidden persuaders out there doing anything secretly to people, but most of what we do is not conscious. Most of what we do is visceral. It is not intellectual. It is not reflective. It is repetitive, ritualistic, fantasy, and that's what makes it effective. That's what in the past has always made religion effective. I would contend that in the present is what makes sport effective, and most certainly what makes patriotism effective.
It's significant, I think, that you choose to end your book not with the example of Barry Bonds, although there is a picture toward the end of the book of Bonds mm-hmm. pointing to the sky, but you end it with a discussion of a coach of whom most of our listeners will certainly never have heard. Tell us a little bit about Linda Head Flanagan.
She is a high school track coach in a little school in New Jersey, and she is trying to explain why she does this. She's part-time. She's paid very poorly. She has two or three kids of her own. She has to leave them to go do her work. She gets flack from parents and some flack from her own athletes, of course. And so she, I think, wisely asks, why the devil am I breaking my neck to do this crazy job of coaching high school track to these girls. I believe it may even be a private school. But she comes out saying at the end that she does it because she wants these girls to know that life is doable and that they can achieve and that they can be all that they might think they would like to be. Essentially that life is more than track and that their experience and their lives are more than athletics of any sort and indeed any interaction that takes place in high school.
So perhaps for the most fortunate of young athletes, the ideal lives.
The ideal does live for some. And I would say it lived for me in North Georgia back in the 50s. I had a wonderful high school football coach who was a human being, a good person. He happened to be the deacon in the First Baptist Church. He was more concerned about us than he was about winning, and we happened to go on and win two state championships. But the gods were kind in that regard. But I experienced that. One of the grandest gifts from God is for any athlete, high school, college, or wherever, to work under and with a coach who is sensible and sensitive and decent, and more power to them.
William J. Baker is the author of Playing with God, subtitled Religion and Modern Sport, published by Harvard University Press. Dr. Baker joined me from the studios of Maine Public Radio in Bangor. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Ben Singer, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to read my review of Playing with God or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Cuban baseball expert and comparative literature professor Roberto Gonzalez Echevarria, who has a fittingly literary way of responding to a request for a mic check.
Complacencies of the peignoir, late coffee and oranges, and the green freedom of a cockatoo upon a rug mingle to dissipate the holy hush of ancient sacrifice. That enough?
No, Professor Gonzalez Echevarria, we can never get enough of Wallace Stevens on this program. If only there were time for you to finish. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org.